Autosport.com. All the news first.
Hello and welcome to the final pre-season Autosport podcast. My name's Henry Hope Frost, and joining me in the studio today are Autosport Editor-in-Chief Andrew Vandenberg.
Welcome back, mate.
Autosport Magazine Editor Charles Bradley.
Hello there.
And Autosport.com Editor Simon Strang.
Hi.
Now, the Australian Grand Prix is little more than a week away, so what can we expect come lights out in Melbourne? To give us a little bit more of an idea of what happened in the pre-season tests in Jerez and Barcelona, joining us live on the phone is Autosport Group F1 editor Johnny Noble.
Hello.
Now, give us your impressions of the shape the teams find themselves in ahead of Melbourne.
Fascinating one, actually, because I spent most of Sunday trawling up and down the paddock, speaking to team bosses, engineers, all that sort of thing. The consensus is it's very, very tight, probably the tightest season we've got. It looks like Red Bull and McLaren may be ahead, but behind that is a fascinating gaggle, Mercedes, Lotus, Ferrari, all neck and neck, so everything to play for.
It's part and parcel of a sort of four-year rules cycle, isn't it, where the cars haven't changed that much since 2009?
It's partly that. I think also the tyre factor is quite important as well. Last season, the Pirellis were brand new. Teams didn't really understand how to get the best of them. This year, that's changed. They've been able to design their cars to make better use of them. I spoke to Pirelli's Paul Hembree on Sunday. He says teams that last season were struggling with tyres like Mercedes have now got on top of it. So, you know, single lap pace is now going to manifest itself in the races. So everyone's getting closer and using the tyres much better.
Hi, John. It's Andy here.
Hello.
You did a really interesting story for the magazine last week comparing a long run that Grosjean and Alonso did towards the end of the test, which showed that maybe Lotus is ahead of Ferrari. Can you talk us through how that works out?
Yeah, I mean, one of the key things to look for in testing, I know everyone looks at the day-by-day times and the headline times and who's quickest overall, but the real crux of testing is long-run pace, because you can't disguise your fuel loads. You've got to have a full race fuel load to run a full race distance. So the first one we saw at Barcelona was on Friday. Raymond Grosjean and Fernando Alonso did a race run in the afternoon about 10 minutes apart. It was fascinating because Fernando needed one stop more on his tyres. His tyres were degrading much higher, not going as well as the Lotus. And after a bit of calculation we've done, it looks like Roman would have finished 4 or 5 seconds ahead of Fernando on the pace he did. But as Alain Permain told me afterwards, that if they're actually racing Fernando, they could have done another stop and been even quicker. So I mean, that was the wake-up call for Ferrari, that, you know, they're not just behind Red Bull and McLaren at the moment, they could be behind other teams as well.
Johnny, how much can we read into these times? I mean, really, just a quick glance through the best times from Barcelona. Kimi Raikkonen quickest, Sergio Perez second quickest in the Sauber, and at the bottom, languishing 20th quickest, some bloke called Vettel.
Yeah, I've heard of him before. I think he's done quite well the past
year.
Yeah, years,
that's
he?
All
yeah.
A bit odd, isn't it?
I think it's fuel loads. At Barcelona, you know, it's quite a heavy penalty for fuel. I think 10 kilos is worth between 0.35 and 0.4 seconds. So if you're running empty on fuel and another car's running 30, 40 kilos, you know, it's a massive differential. I think, from what I understand, Red Bull and McLaren have not done a very low fuel run yet. They've probably done 30, 40 kilos of fuel. Their long-run pace is very good. So I think for that midfield gaggle, you know, the Saubers, the Lotuses, you know, even the Williams, you know, they've been down to 20 kilos, 10 kilos. It's all quite close. We've not yet seen the Red Bull and the McLaren, you know, do their thing in anger. Someone told me last week he reckons that the two teams could be up to 1 second lap quicker than the rest of the field by the time they pump the fuel out and get onto a big aero track like Malaysia.
Johnny, it's Simon here. What's your gut feeling between McLaren and Red Bull? Who do you think has the edge going into Melbourne?
I think neither have got the edge, actually. You look closely at the data, you speak to both teams about where they think they're at. You know, Red Bull's got some worries with reliability. They had a very poor final 2 days in Barcelona. McLaren's had a few little hydraulic issues and an update. The sense I get is that, you know, McLaren could well have solved its high-speed issues. You know, the Red Bull last year was fantastic in high-speed corners, but maybe now McLaren's got the edge. And actually, in the slow-speed stuff, the Red Bull could be better. So we may well have a scenario where it kind of swings between the pair of them, and we could find that, you know, Red Bull may be better again in qualifying, and the McLaren better in the races.
What's the body language been like at McLaren? Because for the past couple of years, they've had some pretty appalling tests, you know, last year with the octopus exhaust, and the year before that with probably the worst car they've ever built. What's the sort of vibe there at the moment?
Quietly confident. I think after the first test, you know, it was a big thing for them, because they've put so much into knowing that they needed to get a good test programme and they needed to start the season well. After the first test, I did an interview with Paddy Lowe, their technical director. Very confident, very upbeat. said even after one day of running, they were much better prepared than they'd been after a few tests last year. So very confident. And since then, calm and cautious. I think they know they've got a good package. They know it's all there. And you don't get any extra points for shouting from the top of the rafters and saying, we've got a title-winning car. So the more teams play it down in pre-season testing, I think you gain a much better sense that actually they're in quite a good position. And when teams like Ferrari are trying to duck away from speaking at all, you know the situation is very different.
We know that times mean nothing, but outside of the headlines, Kimi Raikkonen's doing all the right things, isn't he, so far?
Absolutely. I spoke to Eric Boulier on Sunday. He said, Kimi has had quite limited pre-season testing. He missed the second test because of the Lotus front suspension problem. He lost had a steering problem on the penultimate day in Barcelona, which wasn't ideal. But Eric said he's there straight away. He's got the single lap pace, as we saw with that qualifying simulation. And on long run form, he's doing exceptionally well as well. Eric thinks he's probably a little bit ahead of Grosjean in that area. And I think if the Lotus is as quick as it is, if it's nipping on the heels of McLaren and Red Bull, it could be a very strong start to the season for them.
He's just not going sideways enough for me, frankly.
There's no trees for him to hit here, He should be all right.
Dull.
John, I like a gamble. What do you think I should be putting my money on? Is it worth backing a Lotus for a podium position?
I reckon that one of the wisest things would be Mercedes, actually, because they've been very quiet in terms of what they're doing. And they're the one team, you speak to all the rivals, no one can quite work out where they're up to or what they're at. They've not chased headline times, as in this week's Autosport magazine. They're the team that's done the most laps per day for their testing program. They're top of the list. So it shows how reliable that car is. They've solved all their issues. They're not proclaiming big things. In fact, last year, while they were full of confidence heading into the first race, thinking they had a thing this year, the fact they're not saying anything, I think, shows their confidence. So I reckon Nico Rosberg's not a bad bet. He had a very good race run in the penultimate test at Barcelona. He's quick, seems well fired up by the car and what he's seen. So he could well be the man to plump for if the odds are good.
And he was on the podium in Melbourne 2 years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Last year, he confessed to me over the winter that they went into Melbourne last year thinking they had a Red Bull beater. And it was a bit of a huge wake-up call when the problems with the Mercedes kind of came to light.
They should have paid attention to the cover that we did.
Yeah, exactly. And this year, there is a sense of confidence around that team. And, Ross Brawn seems to have fine-tuned that technical thing. They've got the resources. I've seen some charts of their long-run form that at times has put them ahead of even Red Bull. So I think their weakness may be single-lap pace. They may not be able to extract that single-lap pace from the car, which could cost them, if they're two or three places behind a Red Bull on the grid. But I think we're in for a fascinating season of kind of good Saturdays and strong Sundays and vice versa.
Johnny, you and I have both been writing lots of Ferrari headlines right since we were both at Jerez at the beginning of the pre-season testing extravaganza. What do you think is the situation there? Do you think they're in trouble, or do you think it's more testing, missed?
It's either the ultimate game of bluff so far, and we're all going to be totally shell-shocked in Melbourne when they rock up and get 1-2 on the grid, or I think more realistically, they are a bit behind. Going out trackside, you speak to people who've seen them, the car, it's fine for one or two laps. Fernando at least seems to be able to hustle it when the grip's there and the tyres. But once the tyres go after the second lap, the car's not very precise on entry, it's washing out mid-corner, you can't get the power down. So I think there's a bit of a fundamental kind of rethink there about where they're going out. They don't seem to be able to get a consistent setup. And ultimately, it probably just comes down to downforce. That car has not got the downforce of the McLaren and the Red Bull, and until it gets that, they're not going to sort these handling problems out.
It's a bit ifs and buts, this question, but if Ferrari don't get it right in the first half of this year, can you see a political maelstrom take place where the team falls apart, it gets involved in itself, and it and the competition almost becomes second to the rest of the Ferrari story?
I think if it was a total shambles of a season and the car was a no-hoper, then perhaps. But I think there are positives to this car. I think it has shown occasional glimpses of being on the pace. And one of his issues is that in certain track conditions on certain days, the car is quick and they've had good race runs. The problem is it's a very narrow window and seems to have this peak performance that it can't expand out. So I've got no doubt. I think Ferrari have got a car that they can turn into a competitive machine. The question is how quickly they can get there. And it, as long as there are flashes of it, I don't think there will be this huge political storm at the moment. The question is where it comes after 8 to 10 races. If there, you know, no points on the board, and then they are going to have to do something. So it was such a big call over the winter that this was going to be their championship winning season.
Johnny, Melbourne's a bit of a fickle place, isn't it? It's a sort of semi-permanent venue. No one tests there. The surface is a bit bizarre. And you get a shock result because, you know, people sort of come through when others slip up. So we won't get a true picture of the competitive order until later on, will we?
No, I think it's going to be at least four races before we fully know. Melbourne, you know, can be a weird one. There's not that many high-speed corners. It's all about traction, braking, low-speed direction changes. And then you go to Malaysia, which is, never extreme, very high speed, but very hot, huge tyre degradation. So I think maybe after even the Bahrain Grand Prix, it may take an end to kind of work out where we're at. And that's also the time when Ferrari need to have at least got a grip of their car, because, you know, four races in, if a McLaren or a Red Bull have started pulling away at the front, it's going to be quite hard with the field being so tight to haul their weight back up and take points off the opposition.
You mentioned Bahrain there. Do you think we're going then?
I think we're going. I don't think there's any doubt on that. Unless there's a huge deterioration in the situation there. Bernie Ecclestone and FIA are adamant it's on the calendar, it's staying. And I think only freak circumstances or some big political event would now stop us going.
Thing is, they've paid to host a race, haven't they, Johnny? And Bernie won't want to be sending the check back twice, will he?
No, I don't. He didn't send the check back last year, I don't think. So I think the issue for them is not the money. And I think there's been so many public comments now that this race is happening. Bahrain have invested so heavily in ensuring it happens. I can't see any circumstances under which they'll say, oh no, we'll just hold off for another year. I think there is a determination that nobody's going to be able to stop.
Right, Johnny, thank you, mate. Fascinating views as ever. We'll let you go and get your socks together for your trip to the other side of the world. Thanks for talking to us, Johnny. Have a good season.
No problem. Thank you.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Red Bull introduced a pretty significant upgrade to the RB8 for the test, didn't they? Is it a sign that here's a team in trouble, or one that's well ahead of the game?
No, I don't think it's a team in trouble. I think it's something that a lot of the top teams do, bringing a final upgrade pre-Melbourne. What's more interesting is that when they did apply that upgrade for the last 2 days of the test, they didn't have the consistent amount of running that they really wanted. So neither Sebastian Vettel or Mark Webber really got a lot of time with the new upgrade, and they didn't get to tick all the boxes. And for them, that'll be much more of a worry going in. You know, it means free practice on Friday is now about ticking more of those boxes than they would otherwise have liked. Whereas McLaren, for example, Jensen had a few problems on the Saturday, but Lewis didn't have so many on the Sunday, and they got an awful lot more information out of their upgrade, and they came away a lot happier.
I wish Gary Anderson was able to join us. Our technical consultant was supposed to be here, but he's not able to make it, because you look at the brake ducts at the rear of that car, and they're an aerodynamic aid to channel the air from the back of the Red Bull into that diffuser area, into that sort of low-pressure area with the beam wing. You know, it's not a brake duct, it's an aerodynamic device. I know it's one thing that really sort of gets his go, and I would have been fascinated to hear about that. But just looking at the detail work on there, every year somehow Newey managed to find another way to make the components smaller and smaller. And the way they were at such pains to stop people getting a decent photo of it, I mean, there's something clearly tricked there. And I'd be amazed if that car's not setting the pace when we get to Albert Park and weeks or so, a few days' time, actually, by the time this goes live.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, the McLaren is certainly the best-looking car on the 2012 grid. Is this reflected on its on-track performance thus far, do you think?
Well, we ran a story, I think it was at the end of last weekend, where Jensen was really singing its praises. He really feels that this car is a step forward and that he feels more confident with it. Lewis was saying earlier in the testing season that he felt the car was a much better platform to start the season, but Jensen was very strong on it. It's difficult, as Johnny said, it's difficult to know whether or not we are in a situation where one's ahead of the other. But I don't remember for a long time seeing McLaren so strong at this point in the year. Normally, you know, they're having testing problems, or they haven't had enough running, or the car's not quite on it. This year, they are on it,
So
I just want to see Lewis Hamilton go into that first race in a car that he knows has got a chance of winning and seeing how he reacts to that. Because, you know, it's been a good few years now. I think he was sort of spoiled at the beginning of his career. Those first two seasons, he went into the opening race of the season knowing, you know, even when he was a rookie, that he could win that race. And the last couple of years, that just hasn't been the case for him. And now I think people talk about all the psychological problems and all that. I mean, most of it, I think, is total nonsense. The problem he's had is that he's having to wring the neck of cars that aren't quick enough to win races. Mm. When he's got the best car, he genuinely tends to win the races. And that's what I want to see. I want to see Lewis Hamilton in what's, if not necessarily the best car, quick enough to win the race car. And I think we'll see a character transformed.
For me, I think that's one of the stories of the year, is how Lewis performs this year. Mm. Because I don't entirely agree with Andy. I think there's been times when, you know, his answers to the press have been a bit flaky. He's not been consistent in his story through the course of the year. And you never really know whether Lewis is affected by what's happening off the track. But I do think that given a full, you know, I want to see if he can win the World Championship with a decent car, having put all this behind, has he grown up, really, is the question. Is it all behind him now?
Yeah, we don't want any repeats of strops in career when he gets pole. Do we?
Well, no one needs to see that. What was really? That all about? I was pretty undignified, wasn't it? But each to their own.
Okay, we'll come on to the driver dynamics in a while. Let's move on down the grid. There've been mixed messages coming out of Mercedes. Some reports suggesting the team's right there. Others that it's not, and is in a similar position to last year. Johnny touched on it, obviously, a moment ago. Do we really know what's going on there?
Well, I'm putting my money on them now, on the back of his advice. So they better be right up there. I mean, again, I think Formula One will be a better place if that car's competitive and if Michael Schumacher's got a chance to shine. Certainly, they made some quite astute recruitments in the base. There's certainly no lack of experience or race-winning pedigree among the backroom staff there. And Formula One, it's very complicated, but it's quite simple. If you look at the order of the cars on the grid, that pretty much relates to the amount of money they got and the amount of technical expertise they've got. You can't really perform above the backing that you have, and they've got all the other ingredients there. What they need to do now is start to deliver.
Mm.
I agree with that, but what I thought was interesting about Mercedes this year so far is they took a very different approach to their testing. That they turned up at the first test with the old car and just worked on tyres and totally learnt those tyres with a platform, you know, base platform that they understood completely in last year's car. So when they came to the second test, they were fully prepared and they just got straight on with it. It was quite a confident thing to do, because had they had any problems with that car, they'd have been behind the ball.
Mm.
But as it is, they didn't have very many problems. They did, as Andy said, more laps than anybody else. And there's a fascinating dynamic going on there, I think.
We all got a bit bored, didn't we, of Michael Schumacher winning every Grand Prix between 2000 and 2004.
Yep.
But in that interview we ran with Ross Brawn in Autosport a few weeks ago, he said there's a real sort of desire from people to see Michael winning again.
Yeah, I think the Michael that we see now, there's a very interesting Mark Hughes piece in the current mag where he compares all the drivers against that era of Michael Schumacher when he was just steamrolling all ahead of him. And he's clearly not the driver that he was then. But I think it sort of almost devalues that amazing record-breaking stint to see a driver struggling so. I think there were enough signs last year to show that there's certainly no lack of desire there. But what he hasn't had is a race-winning car.
Mm.
Whether that's going to change this year, I don't know. But it'd be very interesting to see how he behaves when he does find himself in a race-winning position, because you would sort of back him to deliver. You know, he's certainly not going to leave the door open and let someone pass him, is he? You know,
no.
He'd rather put them in the wall than that happen.
He'll have to comply, rather, with these new rules, though, won't he? About the old one move, two moves, bang. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. I think the first person that's going to put that to the test will be him.
I think there was a time when you could expect Michael to outdrive the car. If the car wasn't there, he could still deliver you a victory. I mean, if you look at Hungary in 1998, he didn't have the best car, but he drove brilliantly and beat the two McLarens. If you look at him now, he needs the car. And he needs the car probably even more than Nico Rosberg needs the car. From that perspective, you do think to yourself, maybe this is the last year. Maybe this should be the last year. Get a win and then park it up and go away in a sort of semi-glorious state, really.
I can't quite get my head around Nico Rosberg. I can't decide whether he's whether he's Magger or not.
I think he's really quite good.
Nice. Yeah. He outqualified Michael, didn't he, comfortably, but he didn't outrace the bloke.
Well, how many seasons has he gone now into his career without victory? And he's either going to turn
six.
Yeah. He could either have a Nigel Mansell-esque career where he has half of his Formula One career without a win and then just go and win loads, or he's going to be slightly not as good as everyone thought he was when he first turned up. It's very difficult to know because he has beaten Mike. He's done everything that that's been asked of him against Michael Schumacher. So what happens? We all say Michael Schumacher's not as good as he was. It's very difficult to know, isn't it, how good he actually is. Well, he definitely needs to win this year, though.
He's in a definitely no-win situation, you're saying, with Michael. It's either Michael's lost it or, you know, Nico's never going to get the upper hand in that dynamic, is he? It's not going to be, he's a superstar. It's just going to be, you know, Michael's downturn is the measure there.
And he's always delivered in every car that he's been in, he's delivered. But there's always been a reason why there's no answer.
Yeah. I remember when he set fastest lap in Bahrain in 06 on his debut. Reigning GP2 champion, you know, Keke's lad. You thought, oh, hello. Yeah, strange. Right, let's move on. Ferrari. We've sort of covered Ferrari, haven't we? And we could have.
Well, the only thing I'd like to say about them is I wonder whether you see this quite a lot where teams react to the problems that they previously had and they don't address the problems that they're going to come across. So they've built a car to deal with the tyre situation they had last year, which is they couldn't get the heat into the tyres. To now having a car, well, the tyres have changed for a start. They've made the tyres degrade more. To now a car which is abusing its tyres. So I think maybe that they have sort of built a car to react to last year's problems and have created this year's problems. But the one thing that they have got in their favour is an enormous amount of technical resource behind them. And so even if they are behind Lotus, maybe not so much Mercedes, but if they're behind Lotus now, they will move ahead of them. You know, Lotus do not have the ability to develop a car to the extent that Ferrari do. So I just can't conceive of... It's not like there's a great feature on autosport.com at the moment looking back at the 92 season where they had that twin floor dog of a car. That won't happen anymore. They won't be saddled with this concept that just leaves them mired in the middle of nowhere. Although, did a Lacy lead in Estoril after making a mega start for about 5 minutes that year?
Yeah, but then it all went wrong again.
Well, he was brilliant back then.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. I wonder whether, you know, Fernando... How old is Fernando Alonso now? He's coming up
35, isn't he?
Maybe not.
He's not that old.
Yeah, but he's in his golden period, isn't he? And does he really want to waste it on a team that's not delivering him championship-winning material? I mean, this is a guy that if you talk in the media centre and in the paddock, people still think this guy is probably pound for pound the best Formula One driver in the world, and he's not really being able to show that. And I wonder, you know, it must play on his mind. You know, I want a car that can win.
Well, I think now if he were to win a championship now, he would be the longest gap between titles, I think.
Jack Brabham?
Yeah, I think he's up there now with Brabham's.
Brabham was about 6 years.
Yeah.
60 and 66. Mm. Alonso's only about 30, isn't he, actually?
Something like that.
Because he won in Hungary in 03, which was 9 years ago, and he was 22, 21, 22, 21. Yeah.
There is a bit of paper in front of you that's got the answer to it.
It's worth mentioning Massa as well, actually. I think, you know, he absolutely has to deliver this year. You know, I was writing something that will appear on autosport.com in a couple of weeks' time, and we were thinking about just whether this guy really has got a chance of keeping his seat anymore. I don't think he has, honestly.
No, I think it's absolutely not. He hasn't won a race since 2008. So he hasn't won. The last time he won a race was before Kimi had even left.
You could argue he was supposed to win a race in 2010, couldn't you? But
yeah,
he was denied one.
I'm not a doctor, so I'm not really qualified to say, but I don't think he's been the same again since the knock on the head in Hungary.
There were only four drivers that made Q3 in every race last year, and he was one of them. Does that probably says how much quicker the Ferrari was than the midfield cars? But mind you, he did that generally by having to use his extra sets of soft tyres in a way that Alonso didn't.
And he didn't get a single podium finish in the third best car.
Yeah.
Sorry.
A lot of it hinges on whether he can get to grips with the Pirelli tyres. Quite literally, really. You know, and last year his gap to Alonso was further away than it was the year before, and he really needs to turn that around, because that, you know, they've got potentially Robert Kubica in the wings. They've got, you know, Bianchi. They've got Perez, who's looked very strong in testing this year, actually, to the point where one of the you know, one of the other drivers mentioned it. And I just think, you know, he's got to get on it, because Ferrari don't wait around forever, do they?
No. Right. Talking of someone else who's got to deliver, Kimi Raikkonen and Lotus, they were forced to miss the second test, or the first part of it, after finding that bizarre technical problem. How does something that works on the drawing board and fails so badly on the track work itself out?
It's a funny one, that, isn't it? Because you'd think with all the enormous amounts of simulation data they've got, they'd be able to get ahead of these things. But I guess all the best equipment in the world can't, you know, there's so many three-dimensional forces that are at play there, especially at Barcelona through that super-fast turn three. Well,
that's,
you know,
why they go there, isn't it? That's exactly why they go there.
That, you know, they can't, they just can't simulate that. And obviously they just pushed the, as someone quipped in line, it was proper Colin Chapman era Lotus making something too light and too fragile, and they've had to go back and beef it up again. What was it? Just add lightness.
Just add lightness, yeah.
Well, you've got to remember also that nowadays the tests are all official. They're all regimented. In it, not even so long as 5 years ago, you could go testing and get all this stuff out of the way in a shakedown before anybody could see it. Now it has to happen. It happens in public. Everything you do in testing happens in public. This is when things are supposed to go wrong. So it's not actually that surprising. What perhaps is more surprising is how much weight we put on this sort of problem, you know.
Well, it's like you say, because it's so much of it is done in public now, and there's so much media. When you've got Sky News sending a camera team down there to testing and whatever, and, you know, it's testing is, I think, it's incredibly dull, really, isn't it?
Gone are the days when you can trundle around Snetterton in the fog on a January morning.
Well, exactly. You know,
Flovis. More's the pity.
But, you know, Flovis has sort of come into people's consciousness over the last year or two. But they were using it all the time. They would just go to straight line testing on an aerodrome, or to that place in Mallorca they often go to, and do it all in private. But now, like you say, everything's out in the public domain.
Well, apparently some of the teams were using ultraviolet Flovis in Jerez, so we couldn't see who was using it and who wasn't using it unless you were standing at the back of the pits. But as to your question about Kimi Raikkonen, I think there's no doubt whatsoever he's back on it. I don't have any doubts that his motivation is there. I just think he's going to be one of the fun stories of the year, really.
Yeah, he only missed 2 years, and he last raced in the first year of this batch of cars.
Yeah, curves and all that.
So they're not, you know, and narrow track and narrow tyres. So it's not... 2 years is a long time in Formula 1. It does... 2009 seems a long time ago when Jensen won the title in a Braun, but it wasn't, was it?
When you look at those cars, it seems a long time ago. Yeah. But it just goes to show how quickly your mind adapts to these things. I never thought I'd get used to the wide front wing, narrow rear wing, and now it's the most normal thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Right, that is the front runners covered in the final pre-season Autosport podcast. Join us after the break, and we'll be discussing the midfield runners, including Toro Rosso, Force India, Sauber and Williams.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Right, Charles Bradley is back with us. He's been off to Sky, being a bit of a TV lovey. They just launched their station, haven't they?
Yes, on Friday, March the 9th, they launched their F1 HD channel. Just went for a lunch there with Barney Francis, their MD, and Martin Turner, their big producer guy. Very exciting plans, really. Lots of people on the ground, lots of interesting content, sounds like they're going to have. A big set piece before the Australian Grand Prix is going to be Martin Brundle driving Fernando Alonso's Ferrari around Maranello, which sounds quite exciting, doesn't it? Around a Fiorano test track. And they basically say that, you know, they're the guys that, you know, if they weren't doing what they do, they'd be sat watching on the sofa any given race day. So I think we've got a lot to look forward to there.
They're throwing some kind of resources and logistics and passion at this, aren't they?
Yeah, they have to. I mean, you know, the whole subscription TV package works in that direction. You know, the BBC have done a fantastic job with the resources at their disposal. If you want better, then you've got to pay the money. You know, in a way, the F1 viewer in the UK has never had it so good. Fact is, you've got to pay for it. If you want that to go that extra mile, you've got to pay for it. And if you don't, then fine. Watch BBC; they'll do a great job too.
Any idea what the theme tune is going to be?
doom, and no. I would have done if I'd stuck around.
As long as it's not, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Oh, God, I'll turn over if that's the case.
Or Def Leppard, another great.
Yeah, brilliant. Oh, dear. Shall we talk about the task at hand? Charles, let's start with the kind of the natural sort of leaders, if you like, at the moment in the sort of midfield battle, Toro Rosso. They appear to be in reasonable shape. What's the story from STR, do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting case, Toro Rosso, because he always used to class them as a Red Bull Junior team. I love the way Vida almost fell off his chair then. But they have to do their own chassis now. You know, they're back to being a small team in Fienza, just like Minardi used to be. But I think they're doing a great job with the tools at their disposal. Love their driver lineup. I'm sad for Buemi and Al Kaswari. I think really, really good drivers. But it is so exciting to have Jon-Erik Vern, Daniel Ricciardo, because Red Bull are looking for that, you know, Mark Webber replacement long term, and in these guys, they think they've got a really good chance of someone who could challenge Sebastian Vettel.
Yeah, Andy recovered very quickly, I note, from your spectacular and sudden loss of downforce. Should Mark Webber be looking over his shoulder at the STR boys?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think he's got to. I mean, I wouldn't completely write him off just yet, but those guys have got the pedigree. You know, they're championship winners, they're proven racers. I think Vern got this on the back of some incredibly impressive performances in the rookie test that he did. I don't think they would have dispensed with Buemi and Al-Ghazouari quite so swiftly if they weren't convinced these guys had the skills to pay the bills. The pressure's very much on Webber. I think he's got to deliver this year. He can't just be 4 or 5 tenths behind Vettel in qualifying, because I think they'll think either of those guys could do that and probably be a bit cheaper.
The skills to pay the bills, lifted, I assume, from North Norfolk Digital. Strangy, would you like to say anything about STR?
Well, I just think they're the little team that could, aren't they, really? They always deliver above what they've got to work with. This year, the car really looks very attractive, given that all this year's cars don't look particularly attractive, you know, in person. And so far, it's been fairly, you know, reasonable in testing. It's impossible to know how quick it is, but I think it could be one of the stories of the year, that the Vern Ricciardo battle, actually. I think it's quite a fascinating dynamic there.
Yeah, they've kind of, their careers have sort of gone along together, haven't they? They were teammates in Euro Cup. They're both British Formula 3 champions. There's not much between them, is there?
No, and I thought, I'm going to call him Ricciardo because it's got an extra I. I don't care how he pronounces it. I thought he did a really good job on that HRC.
He's obviously wrong. Yeah.
Well, he clearly is. It's not Ricciardo. It's got an extra I. I thought he did a really good job on that HRT last year. I mean, you're hiding to nothing in a car that's so far off the pace. But to put the Utsi in the shade as quickly as he did, I thought showed someone that's got a bit of something about him. And we'll certainly find out in that car.
And I'll give a shout out to Jon-Erik Vern as well. I did a training weekend with the FFSA. Loic Duval was there, Simon Pagenaud, Grosjean was there, Adrian Tombay, loads of really good French drivers. There was one driver who was on my shoulder all weekend, just pumping me for knowledge. That was Jon-Erik Vern. He was the best team to be with in England, asking me loads and loads of questions. You know, he's a smart cookie. Yeah. He's really, really focused.
Interesting, yeah. Right, moving on. Force India, many people's tip as a dark horse in 2012. Did we see anything in Barcelona to suggest that that's true?
I don't think they look quite as impressive there as they did in Jerez. I think they're clearly a good little team. It's got a great engine there, and they're an established midfield runner now. Mm. I'm not quite as convinced as I was previously that they've got what it takes to make that next step into being a regular sort of Q3 challenger and maybe pushing for sort of top six places. But I'm sure they'll score a hatful of points. Like Toro Rosso, they've got a fantastic driver lineup. I was lucky enough to do quite a lot of A1 GP races, and Nico Hülkenberg is an absolutely sensational superstar of a driver, and I was no surprise that he put that Williams on pole in the wet a couple of years ago in Brazil, and I think given half a chance he'll do the same again. A bit like those STR drivers that are fighting over a Red Bull seat, I think these guys are fighting over Michael Schumacher's seat.
Yeah.
Should he decide to retire from Mercedes or be pushed, whichever way it works out.
Yeah. Do you think Duresta's under a lot of pressure?
Only if there is a lot of pressure, then it's sort of self-imposed because of the potential carrot that's ahead of them in that Mercedes drive. But I don't think the Bianchi test driver role is quite as It's not like when they had Hülkenberg and DiResta previously to that. There was someone they were grooming for a race seat. I think this is more Ferrari wanting to keep an eye on a guy that they might be grooming for a seat.
But if you lose, if you lose to Hülkenberg, does that then, you know, does that then, you know, damage your trajectory, if you like?
Well, I think it depends on the way in which he loses to him. I think if he loses to him in a narrowly close fought contest, probably not. If he's dominated by him, yeah, that's got to be, that'll be definitely be damaging.
Mm. They've both done a season, haven't they? But you could say that Nico Hülkenberg is slightly more rusty than Paul because he missed 2011.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't beat that recent experience. But, I mean, he's young enough and hungry enough. I can't see if that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, but no. Paul hasn't set pole position by a second, has he, in a Williams?
No.
No. But then, on the other hand, I think he did deliver everything that was asked of him last year. And he needs to deliver this year, in my opinion. He needs to deliver against Hülkenberg, but I think he's got the talent to do it.
Yeah. And I think it's a great step up. I mean, I like Suto, but I'd class him in the whole Buemi, Alguersuari level. Just not quite good enough. But I think with Hülkenberg and DiResta, both potential world champion calibre if they prove themselves at this level.
Right. Sauber then set some headline figures. Sergio Perez was second quickest in Barcelona. But surely this most midfield of midfield teams is set for another year of occasional points finishes?
It's difficult to know. I mean, Jenson Button was really outspoken about them at the end of the he said that he was impressed with that car and he thought it was quick. And he thought, you know, Perez's times were fairly, I mean, not the fastest times that they did, but a lot of their long run stuff was fairly genuine because it wasn't on the super soft tyres. And he thought, actually, it was an indication of just how much the entire grid had closed up.
Mm.
So there is a possibility that they could surprise. But with Sauber, you never really know because one minute they're quick and the next minute they're nowhere.
Yeah, Jensen could have been following that car when it had a thimble full of fuel in it. It's so tricky to evaluate, isn't it?
I think he probably knows more than we do, though.
Undoubtedly.
Perez is good, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see him as Alonso's teammate at Ferrari quite comfortably. And Kobayashi is obviously just brilliant entertainment, if not ultimately that quick, I don't think.
I think my highlight of last year was going for a pre-British Grand Prix curry and for Checo Perez to walk in with my mate Khalil Bashir doing likewise.
Yeah.
You know, night before a Grand Prix, I'll have a curry. Brilliant. You know, what a lad.
Brilliant. Kobayashi was he sort of suffered with the DRS, didn't he, last year? It took away that sort of slingshot, kind of gung-ho, do-or-die thing that he was so good at in 2010.
He's a fantastic overtaker, and considering the sort of gaps he goes for, he gets into remarkably few sort of scrapes. It wasn't sort of like Hamilton Massa last year, which, you know, just bordered on the incompetent half the time. You know, some of the stuff he does is sort of genuinely top draw in his overtaking moves.
And he's hilarious to follow on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
I love all that. He is brilliant.
Classic, yeah. Right, we've got four teams still to talk about. Last of the sort of proper midfield teams, Williams. Now, this is a team I really, really hope can salvage something from what was, well, its worst season on record last year. Do we think that this is going to be a better one for this legendary of squads?
Better, but probably only by dint of the fact it couldn't really get any worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, last year they got sucked into that really bad trap of obviously Formula One's an arms race of rapid prototyping. They were building parts that didn't make the car go any quicker. So you've got to have the brain power at the top of the tree making parts that make the car go quicker, then make them faster than everybody else, then put them on the car. And, you know, they were getting it sort of the tail was wagging the dog almost. Mm. If they can get that sorted out, I think the driver lineup's fair. You know, they've both proved themselves in GP2. One's a champion, one's finished runner-up. You know, there's all the hallmarks that this could be the recovery year, but I think they've got to get it right on the car side.
They've got a world championship winning engine in the back of the car now. And one of the things that it's easy to forget is that they're constantly changing their engines, which means that, you know, when they're designing the car and when they're trying to build some kind of consistency, they're fighting against change all the time. But I think, you know, this year they've got an engine that is a definite platform, so they can build on that. And I think it's a long way back for them. They're definitely a midfield team now. And the glory days are a long, long time gone. But I don't think it's over for Williams just yet.
Yeah, you're right. McLaren had four different engines in four seasons and only one with two of them.
Mm.
It was a bit messy, wasn't it? Yeah.
Just there's a worrying amount of sort of blank space on that car as well.
Mm.
And that's never really a good sign.
I don't know about you, but I'm slightly spooked by Senna in a Williams Renault. Are you? That's it's a bit.
Yeah, so he completes the season.
Yeah, just on the Williams thing. So Frank Williams has stepped down from the board. Patrick Head is no longer involved on a day-to-day basis. Are we seeing a wholesale shift in the way this famous old team is run?
It was inevitable anyway. I mean, it was never going to stay the same forever. So yes, you are, but Claire Williams has been promoted to the board. So there's still a family involvement there. And Frank's not going anywhere. He remains team principal. And I don't imagine many decisions will happen on that board that he doesn't agree with. So it's not huge change, really, just at this stage anyway.
Mm. Oh, she's very good, Claire. I'm really pleased for her. I think she'll make a good fist of that.
Yeah, she's been there a good 10 years, hasn't she?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right, the final three teams. We mustn't call them the new teams because they're not new anymore. This is season three, isn't it, for Caterham, nay Lotus, Hispania Racing and Marussia, nay Virgin. What are the prospects for these guys?
I think a little bit more of the same.
Well, I mean, Caterham should be
insightful stuff.
Caterham should be close to the midfield, but you know, if they're not doing that, then what is the point of their existence? Yeah. The other two are just at the moment just surviving, aren't they? At the end of the day, they're just literally surviving in Formula One, and they're moving up the grid comes later. Survival is the first key.
Are Caterham running the 2-litre HPC Vauxhall engine or the 1600 Crossflow Ford?
You've got to make the car first. I can't, obviously, yourself.
Yeah, it just arrives. It just arrives in a box every weekend, and then the race to get it on the grid. I agree with that. I think now they'll be in a void, in a gap between the sort of tail end of the midfield, would be that Williams, Cyber, Force India, whoever, and comfortably ahead of the other teams. Maybe if all the... I mean, Petrov's not a bad driver, and Kovalainen's certainly shown that if there are points to be had, he'll take them. Mm. It's just because cars are so reliable these days, you know, unreliability has basically been outlawed, that there aren't that many opportunities. And so unless they hit the ground running and pick up a freak result in the first three or four races, it's difficult to see how they're going to manage to get a top 10 finish.
That's right. We saw Grand Prix last year with all 24 cars finishing, you know, unprecedented levels. So they're not going to... reliability alone,
15 years ago, being the pace they are off the leading cars would have meant they were scoring a hatful of points, especially if the points then were paid down to 10th.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen now.
No. Yeah. Give it a wet race and they would be scoring points, but it just doesn't seem to happen anymore. The cars don't break down and they don't seem to crash as much either because the drivers seem to be a bit more switched on. Mm.
I think the frustration for me is that Heikki Kovalainen and Timo Glock have been wasted for the last year at least. Mm. I mean, Kovalainen has definitely grown as a driver since his McLaren days. And I think Glock is consistently underrated. And it's a shame to see them struggling around in cars that aren't as worthy of their talent, to be honest. That's my frustration by those teams. So I would like to see Caterham get closer. I've got a feeling they'll be a lot closer to the midfield this year. As for Marussia, it's difficult to see how they're going to do well when they've not actually tested properly. And, you know, it took them until this week, you know, to actually pass the crash tests. So,
yeah, that is frankly unforgivable. You know what you've got to do to pass a crash test. It's the same size, weight, shape as all the other tubs. It's baked in the same kind of oven with the same layers of carbon fibre. And what's going on?
I don't know. You've got Pat Simmons there as well. You think he? I mean, I know he's supposed to be in some sort of consultancy role, as he's not officially allowed back in the paddock just yet. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know why it's so late. I don't know. They've been bottom of the Constructors' Championship for the past 2 years as well. And, you know, they are a better resourced team than HRT. And so they should be finishing ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. And the people they've got working on the race team, like, you know, Boothie's troops are always well organised. But it's just the tools at their disposal just aren't there, and everything's late and never seems to be there when they need it.
I just wanted to say that it's probably lucky for Tony Fernandes that the bottom three don't get relegated in F1 as well, because he could have a double relegation this year.
Right, that's the end of part two of the final pre-season Autosport podcast. Join us in part three. We'll be discussing the drivers and the unique situation Sebastian Vettel could find himself in 2012.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Only Juan Fangio and Michael Schumacher have ever won three titles in a row, so surely Sebastian Vettel starts the season as red-hot favourite to join this elite group. Can he get a third straight title in 2012?
I can see absolutely no reason to doubt that he could. Nothing's changed particularly. No. The rules are the same. There's no reason for that Red Bull not to be absolutely among it. He's shown for two seasons, well, basically for, what was it, the final five races of 2010 and through 2011, that when he's in a position to win, the man does not make mistakes. He is absolutely sensational. And surely there cannot be any detractors now that cannot see that he is one of the greatest F1 drivers of all time. And a third title in a row would not be something that his talents don't warrant.
Yeah, that hopeless, hopeless thing about him not being able to overtake because he's always at the front. And he stuck a wheel on the grass at Monza on the way past Fernando Alonso.
One of the most fantastic overtaking manoeuvres of the year. Mm. But I think if you look back, the near misses we've had for triple world champions, there's always been a reason for it. Whereas Alonso moving to McLaren in 07, Schumacher and the rise of Ferrari to stop Mika doing it. And then, going back before that, Michael moving to Ferrari in 96.
There's
always been a reason. This year, there is no reason why Vettel can't do it.
The only glimmer of hope for fans of close racing is that he is still fallible. I mean, he's not invincible. I mean, the mistake he made in Canada last year proved that he is capable of collapsing under pressure, which at least means, I mean, I agree with Andy, he is a tremendous Formula One driver. But I think at least it means, the other good Formula, and there are a lot of good Formula One drivers at the moment, can challenge him.
Well, what I want to see is him made to work for it. Mm. The other teams to put up a fight. I mean, it wasn't his fault last year that, Webber was miles off the pace and the other teams weren't on the same grid, really. What else could he do?
Yeah, it's early noughties Schumacher, isn't it? Yeah. It wasn't his fault that the car was better than the rest.
It was totally his fault.
He just got on with the job.
Yeah. But if he has to come up against a quicker McLaren, a quick Mercedes and a resurgent Ferrari mid-season, he still triumphs above all that, he definitely will have earned it.
It took Lewis in China to put him under pressure, Jensen in Canada, Alonso in Silverstone, and obviously he seemed to put himself under pressure in Germany for no apparent reason. It's up to everybody else to raise their game. I don't think he's going to be able to drop the ball anytime soon.
Yeah. McLaren then, surely in a good MP427, it's got to be Lewis Hamilton, or maybe not. Jensen Button had the upper hand over Lewis last year. Can he do that again?
I still think Lewis is quicker racing driver than Jenson Button. But there's more to being a good racing driver than just being quick. Mm. And I wonder whether Jenson Button's a better racing driver than Lewis Hamilton is at the moment anyway.
Mm. On these tyres, definitely. I think he owned him last year, didn't he? And the World Championship points served that. Put Lewis under pressure. He kept making really stupid mistakes and blaming it on everything else. But Lewis Hamilton is the man who could easily bounce back this year. And if you were to put money on somebody doing so, it'd have to be him.
Lewis needs a squeaky clean year. Basically, he needs to just deliver, have no problems off the track and just get on with it and quietly get on with it the way Jensen did last year. I think the interesting thing is that McLaren tend to go to Jensen for setup. And if you want to develop this car and you're clever and you want to develop it in your own direction, you can take control, which is basically what Jensen did last year. I think it's really hard to call. I think Lewis is probably out and out a little bit faster, but it's whether or not that's enough. And this is really his year. I mean, this is the year for Lewis to do it. Mm.
Is this sort of Mario Andretti, Ronnie Peterson type thing? Although I think Lewis is probably a little bit better at setup than Ronnie was.
Yeah.
Hard to know if he's good at going sideways, though, isn't
it? Not through wood cut.
Yeah. He doesn't have the right tyres for that.
Rock hard, knackered old Goodyears, yeah. Mark Webber. Is there anything to suggest he'll be closer to Vettel this year?
Yeah, I think so. I think I had a chat with him at Jerez, and there's a definite sense that he's sorted it all out. He came into last season still a bit battered and bruised from the year before, not only psychologically, but also actually physically from some of the injuries that he'd carried during the course of the year. He didn't get a grip on the tyres the way Sebastian Vettel did, who interestingly was the only person to go and visit Pirelli of all the field to understand the tyres properly. Mm. And I think that in general, his whole demeanour is much better. And to be honest, towards the end of the year, there wasn't that much between them. If you actually look at the qualifying times and the fastest race lap times, we're talking, tenths, not half seconds. So I don't think he's going to beat, I personally don't think he's going to beat Vettel over 20 races, but I think he'll win races this year. And I think he'll be a lot closer.
What he needs is finally to put a good Australian Grand Prix together. I think if he does that, if he goes there, gets that monkey off his back, and finally delivers in front of his home crowd, he could be set for a great season.
That's absolutely a good point.
He's never been on the podium there, has he?
I mean, just apart from grabbing that amazing result in the Minardi when obviously he stood on the podium with Stoddy. it all seems to somehow manage to go wrong for him there. But I think if he could put, if he could just put a really good performance in there, I think it would sort him out, you know, psychologically as well as, you know, just getting that momentum up, which is so crucial.
The other thing is, will he be allowed to? Will he be allowed to beat Sebastian Vettel in the same car?
Oh, I think so. I also think, looking back at those three poles he had this year, he never capitalised on what he had, you know, making those terrible starts. You just sort that side of his game out. Everything else is there. You know, it's, you know, it's the old classic join the dots puzzle. If you miss one set of dots, then you can't get the whole picture, and he's just missing out on that final element.
And when you've got a teammate that's doing everything, you know, at 9.5 out of 10, if not 10 out of 10, it doesn't give you room to drop the ball here or there. You know, you've got to be on your A game all the time.
I've got to say, it's more fun when he is delivering, though, because some of the antics he pulled in 2010 were great stories and made the whole championship much more fun to watch.
Not bad for number two at Silverstone. That was quite good, wasn't it?
Mm.
Anyone else sort of stand out perhaps as interesting this year? Someone who has no right to be up front but probably will be?
Well, I'm looking to see how Grosjean gets on against Kimi, because obviously Kimi will get all the headlines as a returning champion and all that jazz. But I think, you know, the time that Grosjean had in F1, you know, and that terrible Renault team was all imploding around him, and then having to go back and do a bit of auto GP and then GP2 or whatever, is sort of rounded him much more as a person. And he's always been quick. And I don't see any reason why he's not going to put the frighteners up, Kimi, a little bit. I think that could be one of the sort of great simmering subplots that takes place over the course of the season.
Of course, he got Shuey's last chance as well last year in his contract. Yeah. You know, if Nico serves him this year, then that's game over, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
The DTM awaits.
Yeah. Right, I think that's the drivers dealt with spectacularly. Finally, there's one new race this year at Austin in Texas, the Circuit of the Americas. We've all seen the track layout. What do we think? Is it going to be any good if they get it built in time?
You never know, do you? You know, you look at them and they look fantastic, and then sometimes they end up being disappointing. I personally think, but I hate watching Bahrain on TV. I think it's so dull to look at.
Yeah.
It's all just a metronomic autodrome, isn't it, really?
And Tilkadrome.
They've done away with that silly loop, though, that made it even worse, haven't they?
But there's quite a lot of elevation. There will be a lot of trees. So it might be quite attractive to, you know, it's just so impossible to say at this point.
I mean, the worry is whether this event's got any form of future, you know, with that New Jersey race hanging around in the background. And that's the one that's, just from a sort of outsider's perspective, seems like a more credible place to hold a Grand Prix in America. You know, there are two bits of America that sort of gets F1. One's the West Coast and one's the East Coast. And they're going into sort of NASCAR territory to host an F1 race. And you just wonder what the desire for it is going to be down there. But then Austin's a really sort of multicultural place, and there's a lot of Latino influence there, and so maybe they'll get excited and get behind the guys there. But I think it's good for F1 to have a US Grand Prix. Quite whether this is the right one for it, I don't know. I need to be convinced. Well, we need to be convinced it's actually taking place first.
They've tried to have a Grand Prix in New York for years, haven't they? I remember a draft calendar from 1984. There was a New York Grand Prix on that, and which obviously never happened.
I mean, you can see why it makes sense. You know, one of the world's great cities, and, you know, places that you think, you know, Europeans might be able to just jump on a flight over. And it should be good. But, you know, all these things require a credible amount of investment. And this is probably not the right time.
If you look at it logically, you'd have a US Grand Prix East and West, just like we had before. Mm. But, you know, Bernie's always going to go where the cash is. So it doesn't always make logical decisions, does it?
Mm. Amazing to think there used to be three American Grand Prix in one season.
It was the thing that, you know, the teams have been crying out for an American race. It's clearly an enormous market with, you know, whether they want to sell cars or their sponsors want to be involved in. So it you know, it's common sense, which doesn't feature particularly prominently often in F1. But I just hope it works. A really good, vibrant US Grand Prix would make the calendar a better thing.
History's against it, though, isn't it? I mean, if you can't make it work at Indianapolis, then you do wonder whether it'll ever really catch on in America.
But that was almost too close to home. It was treading on the 500s and the Brickyard 400s toes, wasn't it?
Yeah, got fantastic crowd figures.
Yeah, but they did trip over themselves more often than not. I mean, you know, the 2005 event with the tyre bonanza. I mean, that was just stupid.
It was a woeful circuit, though, wasn't it? Really?
It was a bad circuit.
I mean, Long Beach was the ideal American Grand Prix for me. And again, that was just a wasted opportunity.
But the only really mega circuit that's come along in the last 5 years is Istanbul. And they've got rid of that. So, you know...
Well, if they could just have build some bigger runoffs at Road America or Road Atlanta or Sebring or...
Well, they're not shorter tracks, but they're shorter tracks that F1 cars could go around. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to Watkins Glen for when Lewis Hamilton and Tony Stewart did that car swap, and it would need tens, if not hundreds of millions of pounds worth of investment to turn that place into an F1 venue.
Like Brands Hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Road America, you'd just ruin it if you...
Yeah, you would. Yeah. Right, that's Formula One dispensed with. Just a quick round table before we end. What's next for you boys then in 2012, Andy? What are you up to?
Setting my alarm clock really early to get up to watch the Australian Grand Prix. It's Mother's Day that weekend as well. People remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Don't forget. Yeah, mine's after Australian Grand Prix, Malaysia, etc. I'm not going, but watch on telly, obviously. Circuit of Ireland. Bit of IRC fever.
Cool.
Yeah,
that is cool.
That'll be good. Lots of Guinness, etc. Yeah, stand back.
Brilliant.
Mine is hopefully Spa for the WEC round. It's the first time to see the Toyotas up against the Audis, which should be good fun.
And for me, well, frankly, if it moves and makes a noise, I love it. Whether I'm watching it or standing there at it, you know, whatever.
It's like a herd of sheep.
Yeah, that's it.
Brilliant.
Just go and stand on the motorway.
Sometimes better races on motorways than in Formula One. No, that is it. Thanks for listening to the final pre-season Autosport podcast. I'm Henry Hope Frost. Thank you to my panel, Andrew Vandenberg, Charles Bradley, Simon Strang and Johnny Noble. Enjoy the season and we'll be back soon. And that's a lap.
Autosport.com. All the news first.